Ukraine.
Jaishankar is the foreign minister of a far-right nutcase government, the Modi government. When the Ukraine war proceeded, Russian troops entered Ukraine, India was asked directly, why are you continuing to buy oil from the Russians? And Jaishankar's comment on this was very interesting. And it showed you the sophistication of the lack of legitimacy of the North. He said to a questioner in front of Antony Blinken, when he was asked, he said, look, I've studied this carefully. He said, the amount of oil India buys in a month, Europe buys from Russia in an afternoon. Think about it. That was his reaction. In other words, if you don't mind me saying so, that was his reaction to that question. He was then asked, why won't India join NATO Plus? One of the US Congress people said, we should allow India into NATO Plus. You know how they are magnanimous. We should allow India into NATO Plus. Jaishankar, the foreign minister of a right-wing government in the Global South, was asked about this magnanimous gesture from a US Congress person, and he responded saying, we don't believe in the NATO mindset. When I first heard that, I was surprised. We don't believe in the NATO mindset. Then, when this war began, you know, this far right-wing government has a very close link with the Israeli government. Very close link. Mr. Modi is very close to Mr. But India has not backed this war. In fact, the official statements coming out of India replicate the statements coming out of China. The official statement is the following. We believe in the two-state solution. Now, I know people on the far left say the two-state solution is garbage, whatever. But I want you to be careful about what this means diplomatically. Basically, what the Indian and Chinese government are saying is we will never sanction the Israeli annexation of Gaza. That's what they mean by saying now the two-state solution cannot be touched. They are saying that the annexation of Gaza is off the table. It's a very important statement now. It doesn't mean they believe idiotically that the Swiss cheese of the West Bank can be converted tomorrow into a two-state solution. I don't think that's what it means at all. It means they are underlining the fact that they will not allow the Israelis to take over Gaza. So even India, far-right-wing government, in this moment, is unwilling to fully back the Israelis. That's interesting to me. What has made all this happen? In this last period, since 2006-2007, and that postcard I gave some of you has a link to the report that our institute did on hyper-imperialism, where you can see some of the empirical data on this. See, we argue that when the financial crisis took hold, triggered by the housing crisis in the US, it opened up what we call the Third Great Depression. So there have been, we argue, three world or global depressions in the modern era. The first global depression was triggered by the railway collapse in the United States, 1893. All three of these depressions were triggered by events in the US. So the first is the railway collapse, 1893. That depression lasted for not such a long period of time, less than a decade. The second depression is triggered by the Wall Street collapse in 1929. And in fact, that depression lasts deep into World War II, which is an interesting thing because I'm of the view that there's no World War I and World War II. It's one long war with a halftime. The halftime lasts from 1919, roughly Versailles, till 1939. It's one long war because it's the same war, the same protagonists on either side. And they were fighting over the same inter-imperialist problem that they all faced. But still, that 1929 depression, the Second Great Depression, lasts well into the war because the war economy helps the recovery. And we argue that the Third Great Depression starts with the collapse of the US housing market 2006-07 and is actually ongoing even now. That you have some relief here and there, largely generated by the moves of monetary policy or commodity prices and so on, But the inflationary problems are ongoing. The problem of employment is ongoing. The move from basically some decent work to precarious work is helping these economies survive, but it's not improving the situation. There's an increased rise in precarious work and so on. So our argument is that in this period, during this long third Great Depression, which is ongoing, there's been a real move that particularly the economies of the global north have been making. A move that, in a sense, has trapped them. You see, the United States, which used to be a net exporter of capital, has since around then been a net importer of capital. Dollars are going back into the United States. Simply doesn't have the surplus to generate a development policy for the third world. No longer can the United States or European countries make big investments in the global south. It's just not happening. You know, they are not able to do it. Rather, they are using their reserves to build up their militaries. So in our study, we calculated that the US military budget annually isn't 900 billion as they 1.5 billion. And that if you add up the military budgets of the United States, the other NATO countries, and the NATO plus countries, Japan, Korea, and so on, it all accumulates to 75% of world military spending. So 75, 3 out of 4 US dollars, world military spending is spent by the NATO countries, NATO plus countries. China is responsible for 10% of world military spending. It's so interesting how the media constructs China as a threat. Russia is something like 3% of world military spending. These are defensive powers. There's only one dangerous military bloc in the world, and that's the one led by the United States, which includes Israel. I mean, this is a really dangerous military bloc. About 15 years ago, I remember writing an article saying that, you know, and Varoufakis was saying this at the same time, that one way to deal with the European unevenness of surplus and debt is to create a Eurobond market, like the US Treasury bonds. So equalize the debt amongst European countries and start selling unified bonds for all European countries so that there's no unevenness between the countries. Yeah? Because Greece was going through a situation of debt. At the time, people just laughed at that. It's impossible. It's a dumb idea, as they often do, right? It's a terrible idea and so on. I don't know if you followed recently. Recently, it is the NATO crowd that has been talking about floating a European bond. But this time, not to alleviate debt pressure or to raise money for development within Europe, railways, you know, high-speed rail. Look at this island, okay? It's crazy. Today I discovered it takes 3.5 hours to drive between Belfast and Dublin, correct?
Yeah.
How many kilometers is it from Belfast to Dublin? 100 kilometers? Between Beijing and Shanghai, there's a high-speed rail that runs at 300 kilometers an hour. You should be able to get on a train in Dublin and get off in Belfast in 25 minutes. 20 minutes, maybe. Why are you driving 3.5 hours? You got a train, 20 minutes. You should have a train. It's crazy. You know, high-speed rail, you know, decent public services and so on. Why not float a bond for that? No. What are they talking about floating a bond for now? Building a new arms industry. Going over 2% of GDP on military spending, plus above that, subsidies to the arms companies. That's what the same kinds of people, European Central Bank, that scoffed at the idea of a Eurobond for development and to equalize the debt in the continent, they are now talking about, we need a Eurobond, but for war, not for peace. Europe's self-image was supposed to be the project of peace. Okay, go back and read the Maastricht Treaty, first paragraph. It's a project of war today, right? I mean, look at this. We're going to have a Eurobond for war. So one point is that the global north has moved essentially from exporting capital for development through all kinds of instruments, including the Club of Paris and the Club of London and so on, to maintaining the capital to build up a military ensemble, enormous military. Yeah, dangerous, threatening military. The United States has 902 military bases. We in our study we have a list, 902, including a terminal at Accra International Airport, where a US soldier can just walk into the country, doesn't even have to show a passport. Their planes just land at this airport and they just walk through the terminal. I've never heard of this anywhere in my life. So on the one side, there's this massive buildup of a military, in a sense, projection. On the other side, while the global north has basically collapsed as a development project, yeah, its whole promise, post-war promise, from the Marshall Plan for Europe to development through the World Bank for the Third World, however bogus that promise, all of that has been locked up, closed, and now all of that development is coming from Asia. The Chinese BRICS and Belt and Road Project, Indian money in Africa, Nigerian money in Central Africa, Indonesian money, and so on. All of that stuff is coming from Asia. So the Namibians, for instance, who used to have to go to the IMF and beg for money, now get loans from the People's Bank of China or the New Development Bank. They are no longer beholden to the global north. The whole width of debt and debt relief is no longer applying to them. That's how the world is changing. That's how these countries are no longer feeling like they need to answer to the master. In fact, it's not subjective reasons that are changing the language. It's an objective shift. But it's an objective shift that we argue in our text that's not happening seamlessly. Because this imperialism of the North, which we call hyper-imperialism, give it the kinetic quality of this imperialism is, we argue, dangerous. 75% of military spending. Look at the way they bombed Iraq or how they destroyed Libya or now the destruction in Israel. It's important you don't see the destruction in Israel in isolation. Like how they destroyed Libya is extraordinary. And it's unremarked. The state is still not recovered. You know, institutions have just been destroyed. There are three governments in Libya. 22 and a half years after the NATO bombing. It's unfathomable. Or the way in which the government in the Democratic Republic of Congo cannot establish its territory. It has lost control of large parts of the country, multinational corporations and their agents running riot. It's back to the days of Livingston and Stanley and so on. So on the one side, it's dangerous because they are ruthless with violence. Ruthless. And that's not just violence of bombing and so on. They're ruthless with the critics of violence. So for instance, Hassan Abu Sita arrives in Berlin Airport for the Palestine conference. A British Palestinian doctor, plastic surgeon, who was there in Gaza during the war, they deport him from the airport. And then Varoufakis, who, you know, is a radical, but he's not like off the limit radical. I mean, I'd be happy to be deported, but not Giannis. You know, he's like a... He doesn't swear. And I think, you know, he's more distinguished looking than me at least. You know, Varoufakis is given a ban from Germany. Not only a ban, and by the way, he ran for the European Parliament from Germany in the last elections. He has a ban, so he can't enter Germany. He has a ban that he can't do a Zoom live in Germany. And he has a ban that he can't send a video to be broadcast in Germany. Most people have just the first ban. I had a 10-year ban from Saudi Arabia. That was great. But they didn't ban me from zooming in or sending a video. But the second word we use for what's happening among the ruling classes of the global north is decadent. And I want to end with this point because, you see, I know when you look across the Atlantic and you look at the miserable United States election And you think, my God, it's a country of 300 million people. And they pick Biden versus Trump. Like the rematch. I mean, I got Ali versus Foreman, the rematch. But that was worth it. You know, both Ali and Foreman were at their prime, somewhat. But this is a really terrible, this is like Ali 20 years later. It's appalling. I mean, it shouldn't be allowed. The first thing is, I know lots of people Biden's age who are completely lucid and clear. And I'm going to explain why I say that. This is not a question of age. He may have some illness or whatever, but this is not an age issue. I was with Atilio Boron, the great Argentinian Marxist in Venezuela last week. Atilio Boron is sharp as a tack, same age as Biden. This is not about age. Trump is not specially insane. I mean, there are lots of crazy people in politics, right? There's nothing. But what's extraordinary is not their personality, Trump, or their age, Biden. What's extraordinary is like so many of the ruling class's products, they have no ideas. They have no project. They have no way to talk to people about solving the basic problems people are facing. Like in Ireland, basic problem, housing. I mean, I don't know how anybody rents an apartment in this city. You know, it's unfathomable. But these guys don't have any project. I mean project in the big sense. In fact, I would say that there has been a kind of intellectual collapse in the global north. I'm sorry to say this, but, and I don't know if any of you are university professors or whatever, but the work coming out of the universities has become a different kind of work. If you're a faculty member, you don't necessarily have the burden of answering questions in your societies. I went to visit the US military bases in Hawaii. I don't know, like half an hour went to the local University of Hawaii bookshop. By the way, University of Hawaii was where they developed Agent Orange, which they used in Vietnam. There should be a sign. You know how now in the United States people say, we are on Algonquin land. It's a land recognition. I don't think you do this in Ireland. They do this where they killed all the native people. They kill them all and then they say, we are standing on their land. I gave a talk there at the university and I said, why do you do that? Why don't you also say, we are standing on the university that created Agent Orange and destroyed the Vietnamese people, you know? Because they feel good saying we are on occupied land. It makes them feel good, like they are doing something so generous to the people massacred. What about your complicity in wars today? Anyway, went to the university library. I was surprised at how the titles produced by the faculty seemed completely detached from the world. Narrow studies, esoteric topics, you know, there's like mass starvation out there. Where are the brains of our world today? You know, where is the German Hegel of today? Or the Jean-Paul Sartre? Are these societies producing intellectuals that raise the big questions of our time? The Bertrand Russells and, you know, whatever. I'm just naming these three because they come to mind, but there were many others. Bertrand Russell is a good example, actually. Russell was a technical philosopher, and yet he was worried about the bomb, about nuclear destruction. He was worried about poverty. He wrote with feeling for his society, you know, not just the technical work. He wrote with feeling for his society, and he intervened to try to elevate the public debate, including with politicians. We may think nothing of the Fabian society, the Fabian, I think nothing of them. It's a mediocre social democratic work. But yet, those intellectuals tried to intervene in the debates, the compelling debates of their time. I don't see that anymore. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that cultural intellectualism in a society, how can you expect your politicians to be anything but mediocre? Politicians don't grow in a vacuum. They are utterly mediocre. And I know people think, well, Xi Jinping is a dictator, but I read his speeches. Fascinating. Compelling reading. The guy is thinking about the problems of our time. And it may be that he doesn't write them himself. Who cares? None of them write their own speeches. The point is that that's what they are reading out. They're talking about the problems of our time, how to solve them. Isaac, who's running for election in Kerala, or Pinarayi Vijayan himself, the chief minister of Kerala, super interesting speeches. He engages with the problems of our time. You know, I'll give you an example, and I really will end with this one. During his first term as chief minister of Kerala, a report came in on his desk. And the report was about how girls of a certain age were dropping out of school. So the way we got the story from his speech was he read the report and he thought, well, why? The real issue is why. He sent his team off to investigate. They came back and they told him, the reason is that this is the public school system, not the private school system. Girls in public schools were dropping out. They came back and said, well, it's actually a very simple answer. The problem is that the moment girls start getting their periods, when they menstruate, they don't have the finances to buy, you know, sanitary napkins and things, so they don't come to school. And what happens is, when they drop out during their period, they often don't return to school later. They feel embarrassed or whatever. So the government had a serious discussion and they said, well, the answer is simple. Girls are dropping out because of the lack of technology to deal with menstruation. Let's provide free sanitary napkins in the girls' bathrooms in school. That's what they started to do. But that was not enough. Then he gave a speech about it. He explained it. He came to the people as a teacher, in a way, that we had this data point. We discovered that this is the likely reason. This was the public policy solution, having these boxes of, say, and now we are going to monitor this to see, because no girl should lose education as a consequence of embarrassment for something which is perfectly biological, right? One example, it's a pretty good example of, in a sense, taking a problem and raising it to philosophy, you understand, philosophy in the generic sense, and making it a moment for the whole culture to reflect on prejudices against women at a time of menstruation. This was, in a sense, an assault on patriarchy. But he did this in such a clever way. A leader. That's not this Olaf Scholz kind of thing. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is this ruling class is dangerous, but also decadent, because they don't want to recognize the real problems of people, and they don't put any effort to try to solve them. So, for instance, in these societies, homelessness is treated not as something that should be solved, but something that should be managed. If girls are dropping out of school, they'll treat that as something to be managed. But a real class that leads society to solve problems, not to manage them. And that's the difference between a decadent ruling class and a ruling class with vitality. And by ruling class, in the second sense, I don't mean it in terms of a bourgeoisie, I mean a class that leads a society. And with the example of Pinarayi Vijayan, he rules to solve problems, not to manage them, with vitality. In an intellectual sense, explaining things to people, not administering things, telling people to shut up and so on. So, when we think of Israel and its destruction of the Palestinians, it's not just a situation of Israel. This is a much broader, slow, lingering decadence and danger that comes from the global north. Thank you.
You were just listening to Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North. He spoke in Dublin, Ireland in late April 2024. Vijay Prashad is an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Arundhati Roy. And we have a series of programs with Vijay Prashad. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North, and for his book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with India's great sarod maestro, Ali Akbar Khan, playing Raga Marwa.
The Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years. SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.